This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Just because you moved to the mountains for some peace and quiet doesn't mean you're going to get it. Ask Jay Lutze. He went to law school, worked in publishing, before escaping to Western North Carolina to write a novel and work to conserve the Appalachian Highlands. Most days he only heard the songs of birds and the rush of a running stream. But one day, the sound of a ringing telephone intruded. He got a call from a 14-year-old girl who sounded very smart and very worried. Her name was Ashley. She said a mining project threatened her family home. She thought the mining company was breaking the law, and she wanted Jay's help. She got it. Jay joined Ashley Cook, her aunt Ollie, and Uncle Curly in stopping the decimation of Bellevue Mountain. Their story is the subject of Jay's new book, Stand Up That Mountain. He reads at the barn at Farrington Village tomorrow night, but first joins me in the studio. Jay Lutze, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Frank. It is fun to be here. It's a hard time to be out of the mountains, but it was kind of cool down here even this morning. So
it's good of you to brave the traffic and now parking difficulties in Durham. Who knew? A few years ago, that wasn't true. But you are kind of an outdoorsy guy, and we're living that life. What were you doing in the mountains when you got the call from Ashley?
I was sort of on an adventure of my own design. I was writing a novel to see if I could write a novel. Something that I had wanted to do for a long time. Since graduating undergraduate, I'd taken 1 year off to write for a solid year. I finished a novel that year, and then going to law school seemed like a practical thing to do. I know it made my parents very happy that I was doing something along those lines. But I wrote all the time when I was in law school, and then I had a job for a short time, and all I wanted to do was get back to the North Carolina mountains where I could sit in peace and quiet and tap away at a typewriter and write novels.
Now, you say get back. You didn't really grow up in the mountains, but you had some experience there,
right? That's right. Both of my parents were on the faculty at Chapel Hill, and my mother was in the School of Social Administrative Medicine. My father was a history professor, and so when they got summer, we got summer as children, and we headed for the mountains, and we did not leave the mountains until it was the day before school started.
So that good life is in your blood. You want to write a book. Why not go back to the hills, peace and quiet, and the phone rings, and it's Ashley.
It's Ashley, and she told me a story that I sort of knew because I was hearing the destruction of Bellevue Mountain before I met Ashley. I was hearing the trees falling, and I had learned that there was a rock-crushing operation. The largest surface mine in western North Carolina was proposed by a mining company right across the valley from my home, and my home is right next to the Appalachian Trail, as close as you can be, actually, without encroaching upon that sacred unit. So I was familiar with it because I'd already run into dead ends, and I knew that the permit had already been issued, and the state was in full support, and the county commissioners were in full support, and there was nothing to do, I didn't believe, until Ashley presented me with a copy of the Mining Act of 1971 that she and her aunt had marked up in orange highlighter, detailing a number of violations of the Mining Act that she had witnessed while being homeschooled.
Ashley's a 14-year-old girl. She hands you a copy of the Mining Act, marked up.
This child was being homeschooled by her aunt because her parents were – she couldn't live at home. Her parents were involved in drugs, and she was being raised by her aunt and uncle. Her uncle Curly gave her an internet connection, a dial-up internet connection for her birthday. And she sat in the corner of their room and – pulled up the Mining Act of 1971, and then she spent months hanging out the window with a camera photographing violations of the Mining Act in her backyard.
Wow. And so when she handed this to you, you looked it over. What'd you think?
I thought she was on to something. I thought this kid knows what she's talking about. I didn't know until that time that you had to have a seismograph on site when you pull a shot of dynamite and that the company had not secured a seismograph. I didn't know you need a DOT driveway connecting permit to connect to a U.S. highway if you were a mining company. But Ashley did, and she documented it all. She put it in my hands, and she said, help me.
Wow. What did you think? You describe yourself as intoxicated in the book. You say you were intoxicated when you saw the connection and the fact that you could actually make a legal case.
Yes. What Ashley had failed to realize in all of her research was that her backyard also included a unit of the National Park System. The Appalachian Trail is not just a dirt path, as her Aunt Ollie liked to call it. It's a federal unit that has certain protections that are accorded to our most important sacred lands.
So, and that became key to the legal battle. So what happens next? I mean, because it seems to me that while it may be remarkable that a 14-year-old girl knows all about the Mine Act, the state of North Carolina probably should have known a little something, huh?
You would like to think that the state of North Carolina knew more about the location of the Appalachian Trail than they actually did. The problem in this case was there were no public hearings at which the state might have learned the location of a nearby hospital or a nursing home or a residence or a unit of the National Park System. That's what public hearings are for. This mining company had crafted their mining permit map in such a way that they buffered their operation, or they thought they did, from the need to give notice to the adjoining landowners. No one requested a hearing, so there were no hearings, so the state was left in the dark about what else was going on in the vicinity.
Tell us about this mining operation. It's owned by a guy named Paul Brown.
Paul Brown, a decent fellow who I grew to like during this process, which really made the writing, I think, much more interesting for me, that Paul Brown was a complex character. He's a tough guy. He's a tough old mountain guy, and he is not used to having to jump through too many hoops. And Paul Brown was ready to go in and crush rock, and he was all about economic development, and he was not too concerned about the national park next door.
And what kind of economic development would there have been if he had continued? Does it really mean a lot more jobs for people who...
A rock crusher, as it's currently run, only employs about 6 people. Now, in the startup phase, you're hiring electricians and welders and people to put the equipment together. But it's heavy machinery, mostly, and a very large investment by Mr. Brown. And that's what he was trying to protect after it came to everyone's attention that the Appalachian Trail was so close to the operation that the state was interested in trying to mitigate or end the impacts.
What would have been the impact? What's the effect of that kind of mining on a mountain like that?
You know, it's really interesting. People in Raleigh, for example, a lot of people live fairly close to a quarry, and Umstead State Park is quite close to a quarry. However, because the ground is flat here, you can't see it, and the sound does not broadcast from the bottom of the quarry and interrupt people's daily lives. This quarry was going in on a high-elevation ridge next to a national park unit, and the Appalachian Trail was put right where it is because it offers scenic vistas for hundreds of miles, and it's up above where the permit was issued for the rock quarry. So there was no way to shield the user experience from seeing the destruction of a mountain, which isn't real pretty to look at. Also, the audible impacts on users of the Appalachian Trail in a place that they go particularly to linger.
Any ecological impact?
There would not have been ecological impact directly upon the federal unit. It was mostly the auditory impacts and the use and enjoyment right. of that national park.
So tell us about the legal fight and how it went.
The legal fight started when I got referred by Josh Stein to John Edwards and Tripp Van Oppen. And Tripp Van Oppen was the director of the Southern Environmental Law Center. And Tripp Van Oppen saw the pictures that I had taken, my neighbor Witt had taken, provided me with, and cringed and said, "Where is this taking place?" And I said, "Right next to the Roan Highlands, which every conservationist knows is really holy ground for rare species and scenic views. And the best 3-day hike maybe in the eastern United States of America is through the Highlands of the Roan."
So you got the Southern Environmental Law Project. You got some other lawyers involved.
We got some private attorneys and some public interest attorneys. The truth is we never could have afforded to bring this case without the support of the Southern Environmental Law Center. They raise their funding through grants and private donations, and then they support cases like this that will set precedents and will create better law down the road while curing imminent harm.
And so tell us, because the other thing that's wonderful about the book is the way these characters work throughout. You really bring them to life. These are people who are integral, Curly and Ollie and certainly Ashley. What was it like working with them in this legal process and on all of this legal team? But really, you know, your best lawyer on the case was Ashley.
That's right. It was really an amazing coming together of pointy-headed lawyers, if you will, and from national conservation organizations who had to trust that Ashley and Ollie and Curly were providing us with accurate information. But the national groups needed Ashley and Ollie and Curly because they had standing to get into court, while the Appalachian Trail did not itself have standing as an adjoining landowner under North Carolina's Mining Act.
So what was it like for them through this process as they could see, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel? There was really hope they might win.
Well, it was it's easy to look back now and remember the parts that were kind of fun and the adrenaline rush of winning a round in court and the devastation of losing a round in court. But the reality is that for 4 years, these people suffered a lot of uncertainty. They would have lost their home. Faye Williams' home was shaking off its foundation just from the initial shots of dynamite that the mining company pulled. And so real lives were at stake, and people's homes and their investment in their homes and in the place that they loved. So the stakes were very, very high. And while the lawyers could have been removed a little bit geographically, the families who were the plaintiffs in the case lived it every single day.
And remember, this is we're not talking about road building here, one and done. This is an ongoing operation.
It's a 99-year lease.
Wow. So eventually you won.
We did.
Tell us about that, about sort of what that was like to win and kind of what that means for.
We had been through so many rounds, and what I learned about my own instincts as a non-practicing attorney is that I have very bad instincts. I guessed wrong at every point.
That makes you kind of infallible in a way.
That's right. That's true. It was a good predictor. So I was very worried that we would lose before the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and we won a unanimous decision. And when the Supreme Court refused to review that decision, we won the case. We set a new precedent. The state not only has the right to correct errors when it learns of them, the error here was not knowing where the Appalachian Trail was. Once they learned that, the state revoked the permit, and all of a sudden, Ashley and I were on the same side as the state. So it was there were many twists. And pretty early on during the case, I thought, this isn't just a case. It's also a book.
It's great to know when the state makes a mistake, we can fix it. And tell me about the book, because you went up there to write a novel. You really didn't want to do the history of this, but you got to know people and a little bit about the culture. What'd you learn?
Well, I had spent all my summers in the mountains. When Ashley called, I know all of Ashley's extended family. Her cousins built my house when I was 5 years old, and I remember Pat and Joe Taylor putting the chinking in my chimney as a boy, and I looked up to those mountain folks a lot. And you know, I write about in the book how we would come home to Chapel Hill in the summers and everybody would make fun of the way we talked, not because we really changed our accents, but because we learned new words and just new ways of talking. And we were fascinated by our mountain neighbors, and to go to battle with them was really a fun way to become more connected to them.
And you say in some ways the stereotype about mountain folk is in a kind of way true, and then in another deeper way unfair.
It's a complex and changing part of the country. It's still quite isolated. I have friends in Big Horse Creek who do not see their cousins in Roaring Creek, which is 6 miles away, because they go to different churches. And it's quite obvious to them why Louise Buchanan has not seen Jimmy Buchanan in 10 years. There is still some cultural isolation. Yeah. Ridges mean something. Landscape still means something in the mountains, and it can isolate people from each other.
So tell us what happened to some of these people. Paul Brown, the owner?
Paul Brown has passed away. He died this year. We had good conversations before he died, and I told him about the book, and he let me interview him twice, which I was very grateful for. Randy Carpenter, who drew the mine permit map in a way that made it difficult for the state to hold public hearings, was recently indicted by a federal grand jury as part of the Penland community's land fraud scheme.
And that's a completely different fraud, but
it's just down the road, and it's actually connected because Randy Carpenter wanted to use the equipment. Once this permit was successfully revoked, he wanted to use that equipment at another site. That one was too close to the Blue Ridge Parkway.
I see. Now, I know that at the end of the book, we learned that Ashley and Aunt Ollie were in a terrible car accident. Well, tell us about that and how they're doing now.
They were. The first reactions to the book, almost everyone who contacts me wants to know that they're doing okay. And they are doing okay. Ashley, in addition to now being an expert on the Mining Act, diagnosed the CV joint problem with my Pathfinder last week. She's a remarkable kid. She has a 4.0 at UNC Greensboro right now and doing very well. But she has pins in her ankle and for the rest of her life will bear some scars from the car accident. Ollie's doing great. She called me a couple of weeks ago and said before she gets to be too dadgum old, she'd like me to take her for one more walk on the Appalachian Trail. Wow. And we'll do that.
You said Ashley was actually reluctant to go away to school.
That's right. Ashley is actually doing distance learning on the internet, which is great for people in rural areas that don't want to leave them but want access to an outstanding college education.
She just didn't want to leave Ollie and Curly. Her.
Especially after the accident, Ashley wants to help around home.
So what happens now?
Oh, gosh. Well, the mountain is healing up. Which is great. The operation had begun. They had removed about 8 acres of trees and begun removing what they call soil overburden, which we call earth.
Earth, yeah.
And so the mountain is healing up, and the state agency functions much more efficiently when mining permits come through their shop.
And how's the novel going?
The novel is still in the drawer. I finished two novels before this came along, and once I started writing this book, I thought, I will never, ever be able to make up characters as vivid and interesting as the people in this story.
Are they going to become a novel? Is this going to...
We'll see what the next life is for this story. Ashley and Ollie are invited to Farrington at the barn. Ashley's ready to go, but she says Aunt Ollie is reluctant to get in the car and travel down here. She's afraid of she says she's still afraid of hobos and the kinds of folks that might hang out in cities.
Farrington Village, rough place. Stay away from Farrington. No, I don't blame him. Jay, thank you so much. Wonderful book. Great story. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jay Lutze's new book, Stand Up That Mountain. He reads and signs books tomorrow at the fearful Farrington Barn, 6:30 p.m. Reception. It's a wonderful place. I joke. It's at McIntyre's Fine Books at 5:30, going to be at the barn at 6:30, and that all happens tomorrow. The book is called Stand Up That Mountain. Jay Lutze is the author, and he spells it L-E-U-T-Z-E. That's the state of things for today. You can find us at stateofthings.org, and we are North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.